Welcome to the Right Turn Radio Podcast. I'm John Cohan.
And I'm Abby Dean.
And you're listening to New England's foremost addiction and mental health program. Tonight we're talking about human trafficking, specifically sex trafficking in the United States. We often think of human trafficking as something that happens to foreigners crossing international borders. You know, modern-day slavery of migrant domestic restaurant or factory workers with little or no pay. But the majority are actually victims of sex trafficking and prostitution. Approximately 83% of confirmed sex trafficking victims in this country are U.S. citizens, with 40% of cases involving children. In fact, at least 100,000 American children are victims of commercial sexual exploitation every year. This is a big industry. We're going to be talking about very difficult subjects tonight containing violent and sexually explicit content. It may be difficult to hear for some listeners.
Tonight we're joined by three women who are at the forefront of the fight against sex trafficking in the U.S. We have Kate Price from the U.S. Commercial Sexual Exploitation of Children and Children's Advocacy Group at Wellesley College and a survivor of human trafficking. We also have Audrey Morrissey on the phone. Hi, Audrey.
Hi.
Associate Director of My Life, My Choice. And we also have Sergeant Detective Donna Gavin, Supervisor, Boston Police Human Trafficking Unit.
Kate, you are an advocate for a children's advocacy group, but you're also a survivor of sexual trafficking. Can you tell us a little of your story?
Sure, absolutely. I am a child advocate. I am not working directly with the CEASE network. I work a lot in partnership with them, but I do work at the Wellesley Centers for Women at Wellesley College, and I am also a PhD student at the University of Massachusetts Boston in sociology and forwarding
Excellent.
My human trafficking research. So yes, I am a survivor from early childhood until early adolescence. I was exploited by someone living in my home, and it was to support this person's drug addiction. The person's primary clientele were truckers. I grew up along a major interstate highway, and it was during the 70s, and it was when the CB radio hit. You know, craze was really big, so it was really pre-internet, and that was the primary mode of communication.
So what was the age range? Because I think when you say that
sure.
kind of vague thing, it's people picture kind
sure.
of adolescent girl.
Yep. Well, I can say this, that my very, 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 very first memory was being sexually abused by my exploiter. And so I'm always hesitant to go on the record
yes.
to say infancy, because then people say you can't remember, you know,
yeah.
all of that stuff.
But very, very young.
Yes, very young. And then my exploiter did leave the home around the age I was 12, 13, around then.
Wow. So I guess I'm watching. I know this is a tough subject, guys.
Mm-hmm.
But so how did it stop for you?
Yeah, it's very strange. But in retrospect, you know, I was told always that only special little girls got to have sex. Only special little girls got to go to parties. That's why I was taken to parties in our garage in our backyard. Is also taken to truck stops, and I was told that only special little girls got to do this. And then about, you know, very age appropriate, I was about fifth, sixth grade, I started spending more time at my friends' houses. And, you know, I had my very first crush, my first major crush. And I was like, okay, this is not normal. This is not what other kids are happening. You know, this is not what's happening in other kids' lives. So I actually confronted my exploiter. And strangely, you know, I said, this isn't fun anymore. Like, I was told that this was something that was fun. I was not necessarily having fun, but I was given drugs. I was given alcohol. So I kind of did have this gauzy, you know, feeling. But those were the words that I could come up with, you know,
mm-hmm.
that this is not fun anymore. And so I thought, okay, this person tells me he loves me. And so I think great, we're just going to stop. And then, you know, instead my exploiter left. And then that created an even bigger schism, because then somehow I had broken up a family.
Right. You'd driven this person away.
Yes. And it was my fault. And I grew up in Appalachia. We were quite poor. And so then when this person left, we were even poorer. And I had really shown the world, our community, that we were somehow a broken family, and it was all my fault.
So,
I know, where do you go from there?
So how did you start putting back the pieces? Yeah. I mean, as you now are getting your PhD. Yeah. There's a little bit of a, you know, I mean, you've worked really hard.
Big journey. Yeah. Education, school was the biggest thing for me. I was first grade when I learned how to read. Oh, my gosh. It was a world. It was books. I just escaped into books. Our education was very suspect where I grew up in Appalachia. You know, it's like you book smarts are just very suspect. And
yes.
So my mother actually had wanted to go to college, but she was told by her father who had abused her that she could learn everything in the factory, that she could learn mm-hmm. by going to college. And so she was trapped. But she really stood up for me when she saw that I had that same academic proclivity. And she drove me to the nearest town library, which was 30 miles away. You know, it was a big thing.
Wow, so she really helped that.
She really did. And she saw my academic talents very early on. And it was not even a question. I was going to college. And I loved that. I escaped into school. That's exactly was like one of the safe places for me.
You've spoken to a lot of the survivors of, you know, exploited children. Mm-hmm. Is your story fairly normal? Is it different from others greatly? What do you hear?
Yeah. Granted, I grew up in Appalachia, you know, not a city, but bottom line is, my story is textbook. I mean, that's what I really put the pieces together of what happened to me when I was getting my master's degree at Simmons College. I was just doing, you know, I would have been a social scientist no matter what had happened to me. There's this great phrase that the former executive director of the Wellesley Centers for Women has is, we study our pain. That is exactly what I did. I studied my pain and I put all of the pieces together. And every time I would read an account about sexual exploitation, about, you know, a study, my blood would just go cold. And I'd be like, that is exactly what happened to me. And I really used education and research to put all of the dots together.
Audrey.
Hi, Audrey.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
We're doing well. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Just wondering, listening to Kate's story, and you have your own story. Is there a generality that you see among these stories of exploited children?
Well, the difference that I see in Kate's story and a lot of the children that we serve at My Life, My Choice, that I can back up for Kate is that usually when it's in the home, it does start at a much younger age. Children are sold much, much younger than when children are exploited by someone outside the home, a pimp or an trafficker outside the home. The average age of entry is with the population who is 12 to 14. But I do hear, when I hear stories such as Kate, as she said, they're like, these kids are being sold, they're like 3, 4, 5, I mean, they're very, very young. So that age, the age that she states, is most common when children are exploited in the home.
Audrey, tell us about the kind of the typical person that you see. What age group are you guys servicing at My Life, My Choice?
Okay. Well, the typical girl that we serve, first of all, let me say that this can happen to any girl. Mm-hmm. So I want to be clear about that. But a lot of the girls that we serve are in the child welfare system. And so these children are exploited due to the fact that they don't have their families in their lives anyway. So exploiters and pimps always promise them a better life. And for these kids, mm-hmm. They really have no comparison. So anything is better than being in this group home. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Our children and a lot of them come from, you know, and the ones that are with families, you know, a lot of them do come from poverty. But again, I want to say, even with that said, that also we have girls who we serve that are living with their families in the suburbs. And these children, although they're not, they don't as often come face-to-face with the exploiters, they still have the internet. So the suburban girls that are coming from those families, they're on the internet. A lot of times they think they're talking to boys their own age, and then they end up being pimps and exploiters. And so those girls, that's how they're all being exposed to the internet. But a lot of the suburban girls who haven't been in the city, you know, they're being recruited online.
When we come back after this break, we're going to talk to Sergeant Detective Donna Gavin of the Boston Police Human Trafficking Unit. And I'm interested in knowing just how this happens and what we can do about it, and what Sergeant Gavin is seeing on the streets. And what are the role of drugs and alcohol in this? Tonight we're talking about sex trafficking in the United States, and we're joined in the studio by Kate Price. She's a child survivor advocate at Wellesley College, and she's also a student at UMass Boston. We have on the phone Audrey Morrissey from My Life, My Choice, and in studio we have Sergeant Detective Donna Gavin of the Boston Police Human Trafficking Unit.
So, Donna, we've talked about, you know, what makes people more likely that if kids have been sexually abused or not supported in the family or are in, you know, have been in the welfare system. But what exactly is sex trafficking? What's the legal term?
So the difference between sexual abuse and sex trafficking is the commercial aspect. The legal definition is the recruitment, harboring, enticement, or obtaining of a person for a commercial sex act or labor. And so it's a third party that's benefiting.
So there's money. There's money involved going to somebody else.
Money or something else exchanged of value.
And is it mostly money, or can it be like drugs and alcohol and stuff?
It can be. For the most part, though, this is a business where we see young children, perhaps runaways. They may be exchanging sex or being exploited for sex to have a place to stay, food, some clothing.
Why are they so exploitable?
The runaways?
Yeah.
Oftentimes they come from families where they do have histories of abuse. They're on the run, and I think research shows that within 48 hours, they're easy prey. A lot of these pimps and traffickers know how to target them. They can, they're savvy people, so they know who to look for.
What are the penalties under law for sex trafficking?
Well, there's a federal law, which they have mandatory minimums, 10 years. We also have a state statute that has mandatory minimums, depending upon if it's a child or an adult.
So that's for the actual person who's selling the kid?
Yes.
Or the adult?
Okay. Yes.
And that, but that's not usually who gets caught.
Well, that's who we target. We also target the buyers. We're really trying to shift our focus because you have to actually address the issue threefold. We in Boston and across the country, where we've realized that this is an exploitative industry where women, for the most part, and children are exploited. So we try to help them or prevent them from being exploited and try to target the buyers who are fueling the industry, and also arrest and hold the traffickers accountable.
I like that, actually. And that's one of the things that I've been really thinking about, changing this from prostitution, which, as the, you know, this sounds like the person has the say and they're the, but it's usually they are under incredible pressure. They're often drugs and alcohol related. I mean, lots of drugs, lots of addiction. And I'd like to hear from Audrey, actually. Sure. Can you talk a little about who you're seeing and what you do to try to help?
Yeah. Well, I want to touch on what she said about the substance abuse. I want to be clear that pimps are not interested in a girl who has a heroin habit. A person who has a heroin habit is not profitable. They're going to steal the money. They're going to use the heroin, right?
Mm-hmm.
You might find adult women who are addicted on street corners that are selling sex for, you know, very cheap. Right, to support a drug habit.
Right.
But these women are women that a lot of them were once children, and because they didn't get out of the commercial sex industry, they ended up on drugs. Mm-hmm. So for myself, that's pretty much my story, being stuck there. And drugs, drugs were really a way of numbing and a way of coping, so I really couldn't, you know, really have a clear mind in, you know, in what I was doing. So I always use this numbing. I always say to myself, if it weren't for the substances, I would have probably ended up in a mental institution.
Right. Yeah.
So I want to be clear about that piece. I mean, there are cases of, you know, yeah, there are some pimps that are, that they themselves have heroin habits and turn girls out, make them work for them to support their habits. And then a lot of times the girls, because he has a habit, you know, end up, you know, in that world. And but once they both get a habit, it's like he's gone, she's gone. So I don't want people to be confused about that.
Okay.
What we do at My Life, My Choice, with, like, these children, they they might have a history of smoking marijuana, but they're not drug dependent,
mm-hmm.
right? They definitely are at risk for being drug dependent. But a girl is not profitable to a pimp if she is strung out on drugs. You know what I mean? So
yep.
that just ruins the business as a whole. So at My Life, My Choice, the goal is to get these young people, you know, while they're still under the age of 18, and educate them, because this is also something that, this is not something that when you walk up to a child or a person, right, that says, yeah, excuse me, I'm a victim.
Right.
Normally you're going to hear say, that's my boyfriend,
yeah.
right?
Right.
So it depends upon the tactic that was used. You might hear a girl say she was a victim if she was raped or kidnapped or something. But when they are seduced, and befriended, right?
Right.
You're not, they're not going to come up and say, I'm a victim.
Right. I mean, I heard in the film we saw you all in, there's somebody talking about the kind of fake family that was created. There was like the group of girls and the dad and the mom and, you know, we'll take care of you. And they kind of had to believe that to keep going.
Exactly. Exactly. And coming, if a lot of, you know, a lot of them, you know, for whatever reason, have no involvement with their family, mm-hmm. and then, or the girl that really, say the girl that had a family, but maybe came from that home that looked healthy, but mom and dad worked all the time. The child might have had everything, but didn't have her parents.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
And so this becomes a world in which, yeah, pimp is daddy.
Yep.
That's the language that a lot of times they use.
Right.
And then they are, you know, they're what they call them, their wife-in-laws, the girls that are with the same pimp, in a sense, do become family, you know, watching each other's back. If one gets into a fight, you know, they're all into it. You know, it's
mm-hmm.
like the same as, you know, they're taught to, in a sense, your family, be one, have each other's back. You know, this family has to look out for each other. You know what I mean? And in some of the cases, the pimp if he has four girls, he's told all of them that in the end he's going to run off with them. You know what I mean? With
right, all of them
they
separately.
They all believe
he loves
that
them
in
best.
The end of this, me and him we're going to take off into the sunset and we're going to leave these other girls. I'll play the game because really the ultimate goal, and what I believe and what he has told me is that him and I are going to take off into the sunset. And that is used when girls are recruited with the use of the seduction tactic.
So basically what happens is somebody looks vulnerable out in the world. Like the example of a mall, if somebody's run away and they're hanging out in a mall. And these guys are really good at finding out if they're vulnerable.
Also, we have a lot of intergenerational violence where we have a lot of cases where it's actually family or family friends, neighbors that have turned young girls out.
Wow.
And so I think that my exploiter, I'm almost certain that his mother was exploited, and I would not be surprised if she exploited him.
Right. So, you know, it's what people know to do. And mm-hmm. and it just seems to me, so there's this whole system, and when we come back from the break, I think we'll probably get some more idea of, we have a pretty good idea of how it happens from generation to generation and how it kind of, it looks. But I think we also have to talk about, you know, how each of you are kind of working to solve this.
Yeah, and how to break the cycles of which is it's such a big problem, and we're starting to see some initiatives towards it. Changing the dynamic a little, and we want to talk to you guys about what we can do to break the cycle, what you guys are doing to help the victims and the exploited, you know, these children, and what we can do as a society, because obviously this has to, you know, we need to look at this fresh. This has to become a more urgent issue that so many children are being exploited. We'll be back right after the break. We're joined in the studio by Kate Price, a child advocate and a student at and a survivor of exploitation, and a student at UMass Boston.
Poor Donna.
And Sergeant Detective Donna Gavin of the Boston Police Human Trafficking Unit. On the phone, we have Audrey Morrissey, Associate Director of My Life, My Choice.
And we've been talking a lot about kids. And, you know, everybody can understand why a 14-year-old doesn't just leave. But, you know, I mean, I know you probably hear it all the time. Why don't you just leave? You know, you're 18, you're 22, you know, you're smart, you're nice. So why don't they just leave?
Absolutely. That's such a perfect question, rehashing. Rehashing that, why doesn't she just leave? In fact, I've been lucky enough that my therapist is a world-renowned trauma expert. And I really thought for a long time about, okay, am I going to go out in the world to be an advocate? Will it be re-traumatizing to me? You know, will it be difficult? And he said, no. He's like, you can do this. He was like, you're articulate, you're strong, you can do this. He goes, but the thing you have to talk about is the leaving part. Why doesn't she just leave? And Rochelle Dalla, who is a researcher in Nebraska, came up. She realized that the statistic is the same as leaving domestic violence. It takes 7 attempts to leave exploitation. It's the exact same as domestic violence, because we don't talk a lot about exploitation in terms of dominance and control. There's a wonderful quote, and I'm paraphrasing it, but it's a quote from a pimp saying, you know, when he's recruiting someone into exploitation, you know, it doesn't matter if the person's pretty. It doesn't matter if the person has sexual expertise. What is most important is that this person is obedient. He says, how do you get obedient? How do you get obedience? You get obedience by someone who has been sexually abused by her father, by her uncle, by her brother, someone she is scared to lose. So we get down to that basic of that belonging, that terror, and also that growing up in abuse and violence. That's, for me, exploitation really is a continuation of interpersonal and systemic violence. So this person's body has literally been formed, has grown up in violence, and is used to dominance and control. That's the norm. So you just can't leave. Your brain is not formed that way. And it also, talking about communities and support systems, and it's like it just takes a long time to form these things. I see Donna nodding.
And I was going to say, sometimes when we meet young women, and they'll say, well, what am I supposed to do? Right. You know, they don't have supportive families, grew up in poverty. They've been doing this since they were young adults, and it's very difficult. And from working with survivors like Sherry Jimenez from the EVA Center, who serves people over 18, mm-hmm. and Audrey and some other wonderful women, it's really difficult, and it can become a lifestyle, and it's not so easy to get out of.
So, Audrey, how do you address that question?
Yeah, I just want to say, you know, to me, an 18-year-old in the population I work with is the same as when she was 15 and 16.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Exactly.
18 is not the magic number. You don't. Right. It's not like, oh, now I'm 18, you know what I mean? And an example of that is kids think when they're 18, they can't even process. Mm-hmm. They go, oh, I'm going to sign myself out of the system. And I say, no, stay in so you get your housing, mm-hmm. go to school, they'll still serve you. They can't even process, right, when I say, sweetie, you're still broke. You still are in the where you were when you were 16 at 18. You're still going to be homeless. Like, the brain still can't process the outcome of life yet.
Yeah.
So that's the same. That, you know, to me, in the population, the girl is no different, particularly to be when she was 16, now she's 18. thinking's still the same. That hasn't matured
right.
at all.
And when you say sign yourself out of the system, it's like DCF or?
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And because so they'll cover through 21.
22.
22 through
and
college.
And they know they don't, right, but they can't even process, oh, yeah, I better stay so they can help me get an apartment. They think, oh, I'm 18.
I'm
they
free.
I've been
people
controlled in my whole life.
Right, and people are still going to use me and abuse me, and I'm still going to have to do things that I don't want to do to have a place to stay. As a matter of fact, the safest bet is to get with the pimp, because at least I have housing, right? Because
yep.
now, right, they find out real quick, oh, yeah, nothing's changed since I was 16. I'm still that same vulnerable person. So they fall for the same thing. And the ones who have been in since they were 14, it's all they know. You know, I mean, when we grow up into something, we believe that that's normal. And here's something else. I think of myself. I had to be retaught how to live. We do not, when you have been in a lifestyle or come from a certain place, right, anything that's unhealthy, and you have no experience in living a healthy life, it's all you know. You literally have to be taught how to live.
That's right. Donna, you were going to say?
Just to reiterate what Audrey was saying, but I think it's lack of education, poverty, mm-hmm. and all of those other things. They really need ways to exit out.
It's in some ways institutionalized oppression. With these kids and adolescents and teenagers as they grow up.
And most of the young girls and young women that we see, to stay in the system to their 21 to go through college, these kids haven't been in school for several years.
Right.
They're not able to, you know, keep a schedule, keep a job. And so
and they've been, like you were saying, Kate, these are children and teenagers who have been raised through trauma.
Absolutely.
So for them to make a choice that's informed mm-hmm. by what we feel is right is asking them a huge, almost an impossibility.
It is impossible. Yeah, we actually adopted our son from foster care. He's 10 now. He was 4 when he came with us. And to see the amount of time that it's taken for his brain to change. And he, mm-hmm. you know, went
yeah.
through emotional neglect. He was sexually abused. I don't want to tell too much of his story, you know, but he was only with one foster family for the 2.5 years. That's almost unheard of.
That's
he
right.
was
yes.
not bounced around. And yet the amount of he's the only child in our home. You know, it's like we have the white picket fence, you know, it's like we have a very normalized, what's very normalized family, and the struggles that he still has. So imagining if a child, has, you know, going from bounced from foster care to foster care to foster care, and you're just living in this total isolation, and then all of a sudden, you know, when we're saying, you know, you turn 18, people have these expectations that you're supposed to have all of these skills and know how to live this way. It is literally impossible to do that. And it's horrible for us to have that expectation on people. And then on top of it, we're going to arrest them for and tell them that they are bad and they're making these bad choices for things when they're literally just trying to survive. We've ignored them.
What are we doing, Donna? What's the city of Boston doing right now?
So we've really tried to shift the focus from arresting the women. We're joined the CEASE Network, which is Cities Engaged Against Sexual Exploitation, which was started by Demand Abolition in Cambridge. We were one of the first 4 cities to join, and it's really about awareness and engaging the community that the sex trade is a very harmful industry, that it's exploiting our young, that it's a huge social problem. We're also trying to target the demand. As we've been talking about, there's no shortage of vulnerable young girls, nor shortage of young men who are willing to be pimps, who are coming out of jail. They've been arrested and convicted with guns and drug arrests. So 3 strikes and you're out. So they've turned their business into prostituting girls and young women. So it's really about disrupting that illegal and harmful trade. And it's about holding the buyers who are fueling the industry.
How do we educate the public? Because people always talk about prostitution as a victimless crime. How do we change that perspective? How do we educate the buyers, the consumers here, that they're doing a very, very, and perpetuating a very harmful thing.
Yes, well, you know, the myth of pretty women really doesn't exist. About in Boston, and I would say across the country, about 80 to 90% of the prostitution that we see is pimp controlled. So we're working with the community, we're working with faith based, with law enforcement throughout the Commonwealth and also federally. But honestly, we're giving the message, as the mayor did and the police commissioner did last week in City Hall, that it's not going to be tolerated anymore. And regardless of who the buyers are, they'll be arrested and they'll be held accountable.
And we know.
And Donna, can I just back that up? And just so you know, people are at the table, Donna and myself included, are at the planning table right now, which we can't really say what we're, you know, we don't want to put it out there, but we are in the planning stages right now of the most effective way to educate the public and reduce the demand in Boston. You know, so we are at the table planning and strategizing on how to make that happen.
And this is what it's going to take is a kind of a sea change of the outlook here. And then when we come back, I want to talk more about what we're doing to help the exploited, because this is the population that is most damaged by all this sex trafficking.
Over the break, we were talking about how it's come indoors and it's all on the internet, and that's one way that it's changed. But I'd like to hear from everybody about how we as a society and we as individuals cannot kind of change the conversation so the right people are getting in trouble for it and the wrong people are not.
And how we're helping.
And how we can help people heal.
Yeah. Audrey, how is My Life, My Choice helping heal the survivors of exploitation?
Okay. Well, I wouldn't call us healers. You know, I like to, we support the girls. The girls have survivor mentors, women who have been recruited in and who have successfully made it out. And so we support them with all kinds of things, helping them to find jobs, helping them with social skills, sometimes taking them out to show them how to eat at a restaurant. Sometimes we have to sit in therapy sessions with them. For example, I might have to say to a girl who's like, oh, I'm not going to see my therapist, and then I'll have to say to survivor, sweetie, let me tell you something. If it wasn't for me having a therapist, I wouldn't be sitting here today. You know what I mean? Like, this is what I had to do. And many of us who have made it to this stage that you see before you. And, you know, a lot of times it's, I give you an example. I went to a session with a young lady, and she really didn't give much. And so I said to her, I said, I tell you what, I really don't know your therapist. I said, but I'm going to share something that I know really held me hostage and really was disturbing for me that happened for me in the lifestyle. And I began to share something really horrific that had happened to me just to show her that, like, I want to get better and I can share this. And then once I shared that, and she knew I didn't know a therapist from a hole in the wall, then she began to open up about some of the horrific things that had happened to her in her life. So sometimes we have to show them, right, you know, you have to teach people how to live. Sometimes we have to teach them how to be in therapy, how to be in treatment, you know what I mean, how to best advocate for themselves through the child welfare system. You know what I mean? Because a lot of them don't know that they really have rights and they have a voice and that they can make a difference, in their services and their care. So really helping them to have a voice. And at My Life, My Choice, we go from, you know, we get them as a victim, teach them that this was something done to you, it is not who you are, let them know that you have survived this, and then we move into a leadership model. At My Life, My Choice, we have a leadership core in which girls will come there, and they're able to use their voices without standing in front of a podium with someone saying, tell your story, get their voices out about sexual exploitation of children in a way that's healthy, and then makes them feel like, you know, that they're making a difference in another young person's life, and that now they're leaders.
Thank you. That was beautiful.
Kate, how did you recover?
Yeah, 12-step programs were actually a very big part of my life. I was never an addict. I honestly just have like a visceral reaction to drugs and alcohol, really. So I was given drugs and alcohol when I was being exploited. But I was always around addicts and alcoholics. And so I actually started going to Al-Anon. And my exploiter was actually the person who told me about Al-Anon after he had a suicide attempt. And I literally spent 5 years in Al-Anon, exactly what Audrey's talking about, learning how to be a person, really getting out of isolation. I had been isolated by every single member of my family. I was told I was disgusting. I was told I thought I was better than myself, because better than everyone else because of education. So I really had to, what it was said in Al-Anon, I had to do the geographical cure. I had to move 300 miles away and isolate myself from my family and from my hometown, just to figure out how to be a human being. And then that was one of the biggest things. And I would go pretty much every day. I went to a meeting for about 5 years.
Now, where, if someone comes to you for help, where do you send them? Where do you steer them?
You know, therapy was also a very huge part. I think it's just that biggest thing of having some sort of human connection. Mm-hmm. That's the kicker, you know, that I'm finding in my research, that, you know, you've been hurt by human beings, but the kicker is that the cure is being healed by relationship. Mm. That is that human connection, that biological necessity for human, healthy human connection. It is so hard, and it takes so long for the body and the brain to change, but it does. And it's wonderful. I've been married for 13 years. I have a son. I have amazing friends, you know, so it takes, I'm 45. I mean, this all happened to me when I was very young. It's taken a long time, but it's possible. The brain changes.
So both you and Audrey are examples and powers of example of hope.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. And I'm lucky. I feel very lucky to say that Audrey is a dear friend and colleague. You know, we present together sometimes, and it's true, you know, and at the same time, I also understand that I was born with a tremendous resilience gene. I was, you know, a grit is the word that there's a wonderful researcher named Angela Lee Duckworth who talks about grit, that is just having that long-term vision. I wanted to be an academic, and gosh darn it, that's what I was going to do.
That's what you did. Donna, what are we going to do moving forward? How can we help? How can our listeners help?
Well, just acknowledging that it's happening here and now, that prostitution and sex trafficking in Boston, it's not something in a foreign country, that it's violence and that it's exploitative, and also that the buying and selling, but the buying is illegal, and that it's not going to be tolerated. If there were no buyers, there'd be no business, and therefore there would be no exploitation and no pimps making money.
Wow. So that's a heavy topic. You want to start thanking people?
I want to thank everybody. I want to know, Audrey, do you have any, is there a website or a phone number that people can access your services, or where would you steer somebody?
Yes, you can just type that in Google.
Okay.
We'll come up, click on our link. It'll tell you about our services, and it will also tell you how to make referrals.
Thanks.
If you find the young person that needs the service.
Thank you, Audrey.
Thank you so much for your work.
Audrey Morrissey, thank you so much for your work. Kate, do you have access your services? How can we do that?
Absolutely. So you can go to my website. It's www.kpadvocacy.com. I'm also running a GoFundMe campaign to help pay for my PhD, and that is www.gofundme.com/supportkpadvocacy.
Okay. Well, we appreciate all the advocacy you do, Kate.
Thank you.
And thank you, Audrey and Kate, for telling your stories. Sergeant Detective Donna Gavin of the Boston Police Human Trafficking Unit, thank you so much for being here. There's a number for the National Human Trafficking Resource Center, 1-888-373-7888. And Donna, thank you. Please come back to the show, all of you guys.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Right Turn Radio Podcast. Check us out at right-turn.org. I'm John Cohan.
And I'm Abby Dean. Remember, be safe and ask for help.